Welcome to Life in Style. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer reader Renee Jenkins. Today we'll be reading from Real Simple magazine as well as Cosmo and Vogue. Let's start with an article from Real Simple. It's entitled, "The Financial Decision That Changed Everything." Sometimes one thoughtful shakeup can make a big difference, as told to Lindsay Stanberry. I spent money on myself to land a better job and the big raise I deserved, says L'Oreal Thompson Patton, age 36, from Evanston, Illinois. I was working in external affairs for a nonprofit, and I learned from some peers in a similar role in the same sector that I was underpaid by nearly $30,000. I tried to negotiate a raise, but I was told in so many words, "Sorry, we're a nonprofit. There's nothing we can do." Determined to find a job that would pay me what I'm worth, I decided to hire a career coach, which, at $100 an hour, was a hefty investment for me on my salary. She helped me update my resume, make a 5-year plan, and come up with a list of non-negotiables for my next job. One day, while scrolling LinkedIn, I found a listing for a director of communication role at a nonprofit that felt like it was created for me. The job description even stated that the ideal candidate should scroll X, Twitter at the time, every morning with coffee, something I still do to this day. Plus, when I visited the company's website, I was thrilled to see that the staff was diverse, one of my non-negotiables. After a few rounds of great interviews, I got the job and increased my salary by $30,000. Receiving the offer and then quitting my job came with a surprising range of emotions. I was pissed that I had been underpaid for so long. That's never a good feeling. But I was proud that I advocated for myself and didn't settle for just any job. I diversified my investments to make progress toward my financial goal, says Sienna Simmons, a Afari, age 33, from Peachtree City, Georgia. While my husband and I had been diligently saving for retirement, we also had big goals we wanted to achieve sooner. We knew investing could help us get there faster, so we started working with a financial firm recommended by my brother-in-law, who is also a client. We gave the firm some money in the low 5 figures to invest and put a chunk into a high-yield savings account. Next, we invested in real estate, putting a down payment on a house as well as 2 other properties. The firm emphasizes goal-based investing, which means we tell our advisor what we want to do with our money both today and in the future. Then they put together a personalized plan to achieve those goals through smart, diversified investments. We meet with our advisor annually to review our portfolio, a mix of low-cost exchange-traded funds and bonds, make sure we're on track to hit our goals, and decide if we want to add or adjust anything. Since we started investing in 2020, we've seen around a 30% return. We know there are ups and downs in the market, and we're playing the long game. I moved to a cheaper city to get out of debt and rethink my spending and saving, says Sierra Young, age 40, in San Francisco. I'm a California girl through and through, but living in San Francisco with a mound of student loan and credit card debt was keeping me in a financial rut. Then, in 2017, I was in Memphis for a conference at my company's headquarters when one of the speakers started talking about the power of the Mississippi Delta. "You're sitting in this room because things grow here," he said, and while he wasn't specifically talking to me, I felt in my gut that I needed to move to Memphis to see how I could grow there. A few months later, my dream job opened within the company, and I made the move to Tennessee. It seemed like fate pushed me to leave California so I could grow in the Delta. I knew I had to make other big changes in my life. Before I moved, I sat down and looked at my finances and saw a clear path forward to free myself from debt. It was a little intimidating and empowering at the same time. My fresh start was a good excuse to get my money in order. The new job didn't include a substantial salary bump, but the cost of living is so much lower in Memphis that it allowed me to make big lifestyle changes. I moved into a less expensive apartment and downloaded an app called YNAB, which stands for You Need a Budget. It encourages users to think about every dollar they spend. Through the app, I started assigning each dollar a purpose. My dining out budget was called community budgeting because I knew that when I did eat out, I should make the time count, and I started carpooling with my work bestie. Being so mindful of my money let me pay off my student loans and all my credit card debt, close to $20,000 total, in the 2 years I lived in Memphis. I did move back to San Francisco. I told you I'm a California girl, but this time without any debt and with a better relationship with money. Also, I was able to keep my job, and I got a raise to account for the cost of living in my new old city. That article from Real Simple Magazine is entitled, Smart Money, the Financial Decision That Changed Everything. Sometimes one thoughtful shakeup can make a big difference, as told to Lindsay Stanberry. Our next article is one we started last time from the Spring Cosmopolitan magazine entitled The Sounds of Now. Thanks to our three cover stars, Kim Petras, Victoria Monet, and Callie Uchis, the future of music looks like something entirely new. More original, more exciting, more effing yes, pull this out of my playlist right now, which is exactly that each of them has been manifesting all along. We started with Kim, so let's pick up where we left off last time. The first L.A. Kim was maybe the hardest to fully realize. She was like a popified version of Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. If Dorothy were a German immigrant who was weaned on 90s Britney, moved to the U.S. as a teenager, and began spitting out EDM music, Kim's version of Kansas, Uckerath, Germany, a rural village awash in greenery, was nothing like she wished it were, so she would spend hours imagining otherwise. I would fantasize. I'd watch The Simple Life and shows about L.A., like 90210 and The O.C. and say, if only my life were like that exciting, she remembers. I was recreating this person, I think, I would have been had I just been born in the U.S. and lived in L.A., and everything got handed to me. Years later, The Simple Life star Paris Hilton, one of my first believers, starred in Kim's first ever music video. She said, you're going to do things, recalls Kim. L.A. Kim was an irritable California brat, perfect for performing songs like the Bubblegum Sugar Baby Anthem, I Don't Want It All. From there, the Kim Petras character universe exploded like Marvel. There was failed artist Kim on her mixtape, Clarity, where she imagined crashing and burning as a way to cope with the inherent risk of her profession. Sociopathic Kim, Kim come with Turn Off the Light, and French language Kim emerged on the album Problematic, a quarantine project inspired by a 23andMe test showing beaucoup de French ancestry. Slut Pop Kim, an alter ego who channeled so much sex positivity that the artist began to feel it offstage too, was a true personal breakthrough. She is the Kim who's not afraid of anything sexual and really not ashamed of her body and really not limiting herself, says Kim. That's something I aspire to be. For me, growing up trans, all of that has been a big deal. Am I supposed to feel sexy? Does anyone think I'm sexy? No. You're the weird school freak is buried in you if you're a trans kid. Her childhood also featured a lot of adults talking about her body. When she was 16, the Daily Mail declared her the world's youngest transsexual. Slut Pop Kim was a chance for Kim to be in the limelight on her own terms. It felt freeing for me to talk about sex as if I never struggled with it, she says. That process led to Strip Club Hottie Kim and the artist's most iconic song, Unholy, with Sam Smith. And finally, in 2023, Feed the Beast, Kim's first mainstream record with a major label, the title born of her desire to chase bigger dreams, bigger shows, bigger everything. I was struggling with myself, she says. Is my ambition a beast? In my ambition, what's wrong with me? That's the character for Feed the Beast, the little lady who gets to feed King Kong. This ambitious version of Kim won big, in music world terms at least. She went on a world tour, netted dream collabs with Nicki Minaj, David Guetta, and City Girls, hit more than 1 billion listeners on Spotify, and secured that Grammy for Best Pop Duo Group Performance for Unholy, becoming the first out transgender artist to win a major category. All of which is how we arrived at Downtown Kim, someone who's thinking very critically about her path toward and whether that will involve an alter ego at all. I want to let you into the darker moments of my life, she says. My childhood felt very hopeless. I felt so outside of society and so made into an object because my identity was constantly talked about. It felt like I had to deal with a lot of things that kids don't have to deal with until they're much older. Now I see the beauty in the darkness. And so for my future project, I'm going to try to talk about that. The specifics of said project are still thoroughly guarded. Kim is indeed back in the studio, but won't reveal much beyond that she's in an experimenting phase. Whether that experimenting results in more club-ready soundtrack to you, nights out pop, or something totally different remains to be seen. I have a lot of depth that I've never expressed, says Kim Petras, Ph.D., and now it's time to do it. That article is from Cosmopolitan Magazine. It's entitled, The Sounds of Now, Kim Petras, by Alexandra Whitaker. Our next article is the cover story of this month's Vogue magazine, entitled Chasing Perfection. The most electrifying superstar in tennis, Coco Gauff, is doing her level best to conquer her own sky-high expectations and win another major in the process, by Abby Aguirre. Coco Gauff is as famous for her poise as she is for her tennis, and in person she cuts a regal figure. The Friday before last season's finals began in Cancun, Mexico in late October, she and other top players attended a gala at the palatial Kempinski Hotel. The 19-year-old American strode in wearing a white linen sundress, side cutouts at the waist, embellished with faux coral, highlighted her sculptural build. Where many of her fellow athletes wore heels of punishing height, she'd chosen platform sandals, better for the feet. She opted out of glam services provided by the Women's Tennis Association to do her own makeup, a natural dewy glow, and her hair was in wide-swept waves. Asked what she thought of Cancun, Gauff said it reminded her of home, Delray Beach in Florida. I love the beach, she told reporters. I'm like a mermaid, so to wake up every day and see the beach is a dream. It had been 7 weeks since Gauff won her first Grand Slam title at the U.S. Open, and the buzz of victory still surrounded her. Although she was the youngest American to win the tournament since Serena Williams in 1999, it felt like a long time coming. Gauff's game can get incredibly physical, and in the U.S. Open final, she often looked like a track star running lateral sprints as she chased down Aryna Sabalenka's powerful ground strokes. When Gauff won with a backhand passing shot down the line, Arthur Ashe Stadium erupted. Gauff has a unique ability to draw energy from a crowd and they from her. This has been true ever since she beat Venus Williams in the first round at Wimbledon in 2019. Gauff was new to the professional tour, ranked 313th and unknown outside of tennis circles. She was also at 15. The youngest woman to qualify for Wimbledon in the Open era. When she won match point, Gauff allowed herself 2 seconds to absorb the shock before making a line for Williams. I said, thank you for everything you've done, Goff told the BBC later. I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her. I told her she was so inspiring, and I've always wanted to tell her that, but I've never had the guts to do it before. Moments after the two shook hands and exchanged words, Goff knelt down on one knee, braced herself with her racket, and prayed. Her composure was as stunning as her athleticism. So was her ability to get out of herself, to see the bigger picture from above. While in the throes of a massive adrenaline rush, when Goff won the U.S. Open, she was 4 years older and ranked number 6. She was wearing her signature shoe by New Balance, and she was one of the highest-paid female athletes in the world. She was a global celebrity whose matches had been watched courtside by Justin Bieber and the Obamas. But as Goff quickly made clear, this was the same person. Goff lay down on the court and covered her face with her hands. She got up and hugged Sabalenka. Then she dropped to her knees in the doubles alley, braced herself with her racket, and prayed. I don't pray for results, she said during the trophy ceremony. I just ask that I get the strength to give it my all, and whatever happens, happens. From the stage, Goff thanked her parents, her mom Candy, a former college track star and teacher who homeschooled Goff from third grade through high school, and her dad, Corey, a former college basketball player who had served as her primary coach. My dad took me to this tournament, sitting right there watching Venus and Serena compete, so it's really incredible to be on this stage, Goff said. She thanked the rest of her team and everyone else in her box. She thanked her grandparents. She thanked her brothers. She thanked New York and all the workers at the competition, all the ball kids, photographers, staff behind the scenes, everyone who made this tournament possible. She even thanked her doubters. Honestly, thank you to the people who didn't believe in me, she said, to those who thought they were putting water on my fire. You were really adding gas to it. And now I'm really burning so bright right now. When she was presented with her prize, a check for $3 million, Goff held the envelope in the air and turned to Billie Jean King, whose activism won equal pay for women players at the U.S. Open in 1973, half a century earlier. Thank you, Billie, for fighting for this, she said loudly into the mic. To tennis heads, Goff's triumph was even sweeter, for the fact that she had been on defense. She wasn't playing well at all, but it didn't matter, said Sophie Amich, a TV commentator and former pro, seated next to me at the gala. She was just going to die, bring one more ball back. There was also much intrigue surrounding the role of her new coach, Brad Gilbert, the ESPN commentator and former world number 4, who once coached Andre Agassi. Gilbert is known for emphasizing the physiological aspects of tennis, what he has called the brain game. His classic book, Winning Ugly, is a field manual for waging mental warfare on the court. Gilbert was at the gala, too, and after the official draw ceremony and a rousing speech by the governor of Quintana Roo, he wandered over to the media table. Coco gave me grief about my shoes, he told the group. Gilbert was wearing a white suit, per the dress code, with sneakers that were mostly black. Goff did not approve. She did like his suit. She felt his white pocket square was on point, but she was not crazy about his belt, which was brown. She gave me the big 2 thumbs down on my belt, Gilbert later told me. She said I would have won best dress, but was disappointed in my shoes. I said, you're right. I should have had white sneakers. The next day, I accompanied Goff to a beachside media junket near the tournament arena. Again, she was meticulously dressed in a fitted peach tank top, wide leg jeans, and burgundy and peach New Balance sneakers. Her mood was part pro athlete in media mode, part sleepy teenager. Pretty much slept until it was time to come here, she said, when I asked how she spent the day. Goff did a joint interview with her doubles partner, the American player Jessica Pegula, and then a series of solo video interviews. Goff was relaxed and, at least on camera, if keenly aware of her status as a role model. At one point, a journalist suggested she never seemed altogether satisfied with her tennis performance. "I am definitely the type of player," Goff said. "Sometimes I do have to remind myself of the things I've accomplished. I think, just my heart, you always want more. Even when I watch those videos at the U.S. Open, I say, man, I want to keep replicating that feeling. And I ask myself questions like, is it going to feel like this when I do it the second time? Obviously, I won't know the answer until I do it." "Is it a bit like a drug?" the journalist asked. "Are you chasing a bit of a high?" "Yeah, it is a high that you do chase. And once you get it," Goff started to laugh and raise a hand in the air. "Don't take drugs, kids. But once you get a little bit of it, you want to keep experiencing it. It is addictive." That night, Goff had her first practice session on the stadium court. Media mode Goff was gone. The laid-back lightheartedness replaced by quiet intensity as she pounded perfect backhand after perfect backhand to her hitting partner. She seemed to be somewhere else, locked into a time zone all her own, her facial expression inscrutable. Gilbert paced around behind her, muttering things I couldn't hear and clearing away the occasional stray ball. Gilbert started working with Goff 42 days before the U.S. Open. They'd had a meeting at Wimbledon after Goff got knocked out in the first round, at which Gilbert shared his view that, with some small adjustments, Goff could get better results quickly. "I'll call it turning the dial a little bit on the radio," Gilbert told me. "It felt like there were little, subtle tweaks that were going to make a big difference." Among the tweaks, the way she had been coached was they wanted her to be a power player. They wanted her to go through people. "I didn't see it that way." Gilbert felt that Goff could use her game differently, accent her strength more, her serve, her backhand, her insanely great movement, her defending skills. He saw room for more tactics and strategy, for more taking advantage of her opponent's weaknesses. Gilbert did not share the universal fixation with Goff's forehand, deemed to be her one weak spot. When the tennis world started to notice that Gilbert was working with Goff, he got an avalanche of texts. "Fix her forehand! Fix her forehand!" "It's pretty amazing that that's all everybody ever talks about," he said. To hear Gilbert tell it, Goff's kryptonite is not her forehand. Her kryptonite, if she has one, is her perfectionism. Gilbert, Coco definitely shares a big-time trait with Andre in that she's a perfectionist, crazy perfectionist. "That's probably the thing from early on I noticed instantly, and I told her the pursuit of perfection doesn't exist. It makes you miserable chasing it, and you're never satisfied with being good. She's just always got to be better. Andre was the same, and it's like, you only got to be better than the lady on the other side of the net. That's it. This whole being better than you need to be cost you a lot of matches." It was Goff's dad, Corey, who pushed her to work with Gilbert. He also urged her to bring in Pierre Riba, the former pro from Spain who coached her for a few months over the summer. After the meeting at Wimbledon, her mom, Candy, got the Winning Ugly audiobook and started listening to it. She liked how practical the guidance was. "I said, this is the part that she needs," Candy told me. Some of Gilbert's observations weren't news to Goff's parents. The perfectionism thing, it had always been there. "Starting from 3 or 4, she tried to win at everything she did," Corey told me, "not just tennis." Candy recalled that when Goff was in the first grade, she came undone because she got one word wrong on a spelling test. She was so fixated on the fact that she got one wrong. "To me, that was too much of an upsetting moment for her to have," Candy said. Gilbert can sometimes get through to Goff where her parents can't. "He'll say the same thing, but coming from me, she receives it differently," Corey said, sounding very much like the parent of a teenager. "If I say, you can beat these girls, it's, Dad, it's not that easy. He says it, and it's like, the girls got no chance." In this respect, Gilbert and others can at times serve as a go-between. when we try to tell her certain things, it's deaf ears sometimes, Candy says. I can't tell her what to do tennis-wise. If I want something to be said, I gotta kind of, she gestured with her arm, indicating that she had to take a Sarah Tippett's route. There's a limit to the amount of direction golf will take from Gilbert, too, it seems. During her fourth round match with Carolyn Wozniacki at the U.S. Open, Gilbert and Reba were dispensing advice courtside, and microphones picked up Goff telling them to be quiet. Please just stop, Goff said. Stop talking. Gilbert told me that when Goff wants to tease him or rein him in, she likes to remind him that she is his star pupil and a less-than-stellar record against Pete Sampras. Did you coach Andre? Goff likes to say. When you were coaching Andre, how did he do against Pete? The tournament opened on a Sunday afternoon. From the start, the crowd was pulling for Goff. Vamos, Coco, fans would yell. Venga, Coco. During her first doubles match, a man in the upper bleachers cried out, Coco, will you marry me? The next day, Goff made a short shift of Ons Jabeur, taking less than an hour to beat her in straight sets. But the tennis was soon overshadowed by conditions in the arena. The venue had been built up for the competition quickly on top of a golf course, and the court had an uneven surface causing balls to bounce unpredictably. Heavy rain and wind led to constant delays, raising the question of why the tournament was taking place on an outdoor court during Cancun's wet season. Amid a growing chorus of player complaints, the WTA conceded that its tour finals were not a perfect event. In one clip that made the rounds online, Goff was waiting out a rain delay when a gust of wind flipped her umbrella upside down. She cracked a sly smile. The wind eventually destroyed so many umbrellas that the players started requesting towels instead. During a particular chaotic doubles match, the wind blew Pegula's visor off her head, swept a trash can onto the court, and toppled potted plants. In another, Goff had to stop serving because a bat flew into her line of sight and swooped around the court. Another smirk. The obstacles became so absurd that one website compared the competition to the Fry Festival. It was a tournament engineered to derail any perfectionist. In other words, and Goff certainly had her moments, she complained about the uneven court. She flung her racket in anger. In the end, she was knocked out in the semifinals by her doubles partner, Pegula, and together they were eliminated from the doubles contest before the semis. And we will pause there and continue this article next time. That article is the cover story of this month's Vogue magazine entitled Chasing Perfection. The most electrifying superstar in tennis, Coco Gauff, is doing her level best to conquer her own sky-high expectations and win another major in the process. By Abby Aguirre. And that's all the time we have today for Life and Style. I'm Virginia Voice volunteer reader Renee Jenkins. This program is available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org. Have a great day.